This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. The documentary film we're watching for this month as part of Marketplace's Econ Extra Credit project is about a campaign from the 1970s by office workers for better treatment, higher pay, and respect. It's called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. There's a scene in the documentary toward the dawn of that movement when an administrative person is sitting there at work at an office at Harvard University, and this happens.
It was noon. There was nobody else in the office except for me. A student comes in and looks me dead in the eye and says, "Isn't anybody here? Can't you see me? I'm right in front of your eyes. I'm here."
That is Kara Nussbaum, who went on to become a key leader of the 9 to 5 movement, who much later had a senior role in the Labor Department under Clinton. She joins us now. Ms. Nussbaum, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So someone in the film says the bosses regarded the admins, secretaries back then, like kind of work spouses. But not even that, when you hear you right there, it's not the invisible man, it was the invisible woman.
I'll tell you, in those days, it was those issues of respect that hit us first, because we took for granted the issues of pay, bizarrely. We thought we were special because we wore nice clothes to work, but it wasn't until we started actually looking at the data when we started 9 to 5 that we found that office workers, secretaries, earned less than factory workers. And then, of course, we came to realize that that's because they had a union and we didn't. But the notion that somehow we were expendable, not important, not even worthy of knowing our names very often. We had members of the organization who said their bosses couldn't keep them straight when there were two women in the office. They got their names mixed up. And that in general, it was assumed that the biggest, most important sector of the workforce was men in hard hats. But in fact, it was us. It was women at keyboards and typewriters who were the largest sector of the workforce at the time. And 9 to 5 was about flexing that muscle.
Now, the film shows that it didn't just transform from the world of disrespect that you're describing here and the world of creeps that you see in the TV show Mad Men in the 60s to what we have later just because feminism happened. You and your colleagues at 9 to 5 had to figure out what to do and then try to get the feminist movement and the labor movement on board.
We built an organization that we wanted to join. We had to carve out our own space, both in the women's movement and the labor movement, a place where you didn't have to know the secret words or agree with the set of assumptions in order to begin to organize for change. So we never called ourselves feminists. And in the film, you'll see so many of our members say, "Yeah, people used to say, I'm no women's liber, but," or "I'm not a feminist," but they were down for all of the most important ideas. I used to think that you shouldn't let your words be the enemy of your ideas. And that was true both on the labor side and on the feminist side. And so we built a new kind of organization, and it was wildly successful. We had thousands of people active all the time. We had millions who were cheering us on, and we had basically no backlash either.
But the bosses were not wild about it, though, were they?
We did have backlash from the bosses. That is absolutely true. And in fact, at the time, the guys who were running these offices, they didn't even have enough sense to be embarrassed by what we were calling them out on. And, you know, they would admit that they had sent a woman to the bar to pick up a good-looking girl for him. Right there on television, a boss admits to doing that. And they certainly were resistant to unions. When we started our union, District 9 to 5 and SEIU, they came down hard.
They came down hard. And it's more than respect. It's more than opening up paths for people to lodge grievances when they're wronged. It also emerges, I mean, in Boston, I think it was, that companies, different companies, would gather together in a meeting to essentially fix prices on what they paid their secretaries.
We discovered through an anonymous tip from a secretary that the biggest clerical employers in Boston were setting wages through the Boston Survey Group. And it was a secret organization. They met monthly. But we found out through secretaries when and where they were meeting. We confronted them. They were walking in with boxes of key punch cards because that's how they kept clerical data in those days. And they set the wages. We embarrassed them in front of the companies. We went to their board meetings, but we also went to the Massachusetts Attorney General. We filed a suit against them for not price fixing, but wage fixing. And so that was a big departure that had never been done before. And finally, they caved. They disbanded the group and no longer set wages, and in many cases had to increase pay by 10% or more. And it was the best example of the kind of savvy that it took in order to know what levers of political power we had to wield as well. And those changes were the kinds of fights that showed that you could go up against the boss. You could beat them at their own game by showing the power of working women. And it was exhilarating, David, I have to tell you.
I mean, it certainly traveled outside of Boston. You had chapters all over the country, as far away as Atlanta, Seattle.
We did. We were organized all over the place. Women everywhere wanted to be part of this new change. And it was one that just made so much sense in the time of what was rupture in every part of our society. You had political rupture, upheaval with Nixon being forced out of office. You had social upheaval with both the civil rights and the women's movement changing expectations. And you had economic upheaval with new technology and globalization and an employer class that was deciding that they were really going to come down even harder on pay and benefits and try to compete on the low road by driving down costs. These changes swirling around created this opening for women who were all concentrated in the same kinds of jobs, whether you were a middle-class woman with a college education or a working-class woman with a high school education, black, brown, or white. We were in the same boat, and we joined together. And it gave us tremendous momentum, which then just catapulted even further when Jane Fonda made a movie about us.
Yeah, just so people are clear, that came after, but there was kind of a dialogue between your movement and the movie. The movie got some ideas from your work, but also, even though it's a, what should we call it? The filmmakers call it a satire. I'm led to believe it helped the work you were doing.
I had known Jane Fonda in the anti-war movement, and we remained friends, and I was telling her about my work as a clerical worker and our organizing in 9 to 5, and it was her idea to make a movie. And at first she wanted to make it a drama, but then she met with our members, and in the course of a long discussion one night in Cleveland with about 40 of our members, she asked them, "Have you ever dreamed of getting even with your boss?" And the place lit up. Everybody had a fantasy about killing their boss, getting even with their boss. And that's when she decided that it had to be a farce. So the movie was more modern times than Norma Rae. And I think that's what made it such a huge success. It meant that you could go into a movie theater in 1980 and not identify with a movement or a cause, just wanting to have a good time, then see yourself up in that screen and come out of the theater thinking, that's ridiculous. No one should have to put up with that. And it was that kind of leapfrog of expectations that the movie provided to a movement that was already organized all over the country.
You know, it's your work, it's your team, later the film, but also in the context of changes in the law and the federal EEOC, right? I mean, that also plays into some of the things you're able to do.
Oh, we work closely with the Carter administration, with the OFCCP, the EEOC. We used every tool that was available to us. And in fact, these federal agencies targeted big concentrations of women office workers, the banking industry, the insurance industry, and they were effective. They forced change because we went to them to get them to do their job. that's the kind of collaboration that I think we've got to see, and then so much more with the Biden administration, that we've got to get government doing its job in the first place. We need to meet the unfulfilled promise of the 1970s, and that is that working people need the kind of day-to-day ongoing power that allows them to have some say over their working conditions, over their pay, over, you know, how they're going to be treated under COVID, for example. So it's got to be both about standards and about power. And this is our last best chance.
The current administration is what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. The making these changes over the next 4 years is our last best chance to make the profound systemic changes that we need.
I mean, unions in general were stronger in the 70s. Then the Reagan administration comes, which the film focuses on. Now you're the director, the founding director of Working America. That's the largest non-union workers group in the United States. It says something, right, that there's so much work to do with people who are not unionized these days.
We felt we had this tremendous momentum in the 1970s, and we did, but we didn't see what was coming in the 1980s. We announced the national expansion of our union, District 9 to 5, the very same week that Reagan decides he's going to fire everybody at PATCO.
That's the Air Traffic Controllers Union, which the administration worked to disband, essentially.
Right, yeah, and they did. Reagan decides to come out, fire everybody at the Air Traffic Controllers Association. It's the opening shot on what now became a national campaign backed by the federal government to get rid of unions. And that's been the trajectory that we've lived under for the last two generations. Big corporate powers were willing to make concessions. You know, women were allowed to become managers and professionals, and now women enjoy many more opportunities. But that was true largely for middle-class women, for white women. But for the rest of working people, women and men, things got much worse in the period where unions were being taken out and a consolidation of right-wing political power was taking place at the same time. We need to now look at how do we learn the lessons from the 1970s. We're in a similar period of upheaval. How do we make sure that we make advances in this next decade, not just for a few, but for the many?
Right. And in your current work with Working America, you're not waiting for the groups to unionize, then take it from there. You're working with people who are non-union to try to address some of these issues.
In the early 2000s, we decided to go door-to-door to talk to working people who don't have a union on the job about, you know, good pay, good jobs, education, retirement, healthcare. And to see whether these are the issues that they cared about and whether they would join an organization to do something about it. Well, two out of three people we talk to every single night join up. They want to be part of a group of people that fights back. But under our current labor laws, you've got to get the boss to agree that you can even have an election. Working America, with our 3 million members, demonstrates that there's an awful lot of interest out there in joining a union, in having a say, in changing the trajectory for working families. Now, I think if we can change those labor laws, if we can pass the new bill before the Congress called the PRO Act that will update labor laws, then we're going to begin to see that frustration alleviated. People will actually have the opportunity to have a say over their work lives.
Karen Nussbaum with Working America These Days was also the director of the Labor Department's Women's Bureau during the first Clinton administration. And you get to know a lot more about Karen Nussbaum in the documentary film 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. Ms. Nussbaum, thank you so much.
Thank you.